We're talking about the state of clothes shopping at this point in the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Amazon has surpassed Walmart as the number one apparel retailer in the U.S. It's partly fueled by the pandemic online shopping boom we've seen, and that's from Wells Fargo analysts last month. They now estimate Amazon will surpass $45 billion in apparel and footwear sales this year. Whit, when was the last time you added to your wardrobe? Are you buying clothes for work or for your kids who may be growing like beanstalks? It's 800-642-1234. Lauren Thomas is a reporter for CNBC covering the retail landscape. Lauren, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so how about broad strokes first on the apparel retail scene? What have you seen happen to the retail industry over the past pandemic year?
Sure. So it's been a roller coaster. I think roller coaster is probably a word that we can use to describe the state of many things during this pandemic. But definitely the apparel industry, I think, you know, you think back to a year ago and many of us stuck at home, you know, immediately shifted to no longer putting on a dress or a suit to wear to work in the office every day, but it was sweatpants and pajamas and loungewear. So throughout the course of the past year, you know, you really saw sales of more comfortable clothes. Again, you know, anything with stretchy fabrics that really accelerated, and you saw many traditional apparel retailers, department stores, kind of pivot their merchandise, especially online, to really market, you know, pajamas, and that was the new working from home wardrobe, so to speak. Now, as you know, as we entered into the new year, and especially throughout March and now into April, you're starting to see that reverse course a bit. You know, companies like Anthropologie, even Macy's has hinted at, you know, sales of dresses and more formal wear are just starting to tick back up. And you could do a quick survey, you know, on many retailers' websites, and you're now seeing them advertise, you know, pastel and spring-colored clothes. It's much less of that loungewear and pajamas that we saw this time a year ago.
Very subtle hints of normalcy is what I'm hearing from you.
Right. Yeah. No, that's really a good way to summarize it. I think many Americans, you know, comfort is great, but there's something that, you know, I think people are ready to get back to dressing up. It's one of those signs of normalcy, I guess, that we're seeing coming out of this pandemic. It's just watching apparel sales in the categories and how they're changing, and you know, companies are shifting their marketing again back toward that more formal wear.
Yeah, you know, how much did clothes sales drop in the pandemic? Did apparel sales drop considerably? Could you really see that decline last year?
Yeah, you could really, really see that decline. So first, I'll point out the categories that were up, and this is according to, I've got some sales in front of me, so that's according to NPD data. So like sales of sweatpants were up 17%, slipper sales were up 21%.
Now, oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I know. So again, that comfort. On the whole, though, like you said, apparel sales were down 19% last year. Again, that's according to NPD data. So double-digit declines, almost 20% for apparel on the whole. But within that, you saw some bright spots. Pajamas, I think, were up 6% for the year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, kids still grow in a pandemic. I mean, my kids were still going up in sizes, so I continually had to, well, I did do it online.
Right.
So, you know, there has to be some categories or some give and take here because, you know, for instance, kids grow.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, you mentioned at the start of this segment that Amazon, you know, they've overtaken Walmart as the biggest apparel retailer. They do have a pretty strong kids business. Now, they've managed to bring in, you know, other brands as well, Children's Place, for example, to do, you know, collaborations of sorts, I guess, to have like apparel lines for kids that sell on Amazon. So that's a pretty strong business for them. But yeah, within, you know, when I talk to to apparel experts, you know, they do mention children's is again another spot. I think Target and Walmart both saw that last year. It was still a spot of growth because, like you said, kids are still growing. But I would imagine, you know, the sweatpants and T-shirts and whatnot were pretty popular with the kids as well.
Yeah, you got that. Lauren Thomas is with us, a reporter for CNBC, covering the retail industry. How has the pandemic affected your shopping habits? Were you buying clothes online or maybe in thrift stores? Have you gone to the mall lately? What are you seeing out there? Has your child style changed in the pandemic? 800-642-1234. All right, Lauren, here we go. There are about 1,000 malls in the U.S. How are they doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mall, the story of the mall, I guess, the state of the mall has been something that I've covered pretty closely at CNBC. Like you said, there are about 1,000 of them. About a year ago, a pretty big report came out from one firm, Coresight Research, that tracks the retail industry very closely as well. They said that they anticipate about 25% of those malls are going to shut down permanently within the next 5 years. So by about, you know, 2025. So that would be, you know, 250 or so malls. Now, when you look at the mall landscape, there's kind of a rating system that a lot of people follow. So you've got A malls, B malls, C malls, and D malls. And as you would imagine, the A malls are really strong. Those do the most sales per square foot, tend to be maybe located in communities where there's a bit more wealth and just stronger population. So it's those C and D malls that I think have reached a point where maybe they've lost a few department stores over the years. Maybe the Sears has closed, the JCPenney has closed. You know, we've seen a number of those department store retailers file for bankruptcy. And so, again, those C and D malls have struggled the most to backfill those empty spaces as they do close. And those are the ones, I think, that are most at risk of that permanent closure. A super timely report actually just came out this morning that we covered exclusively for CNBC. It's some new data from Moody's that showed that during the first quarter, vacancy rates in malls, so this is an average vacancy rate, which tracks empty space basically in malls, that made its biggest leap quarter over quarter. So from the fourth quarter to the first quarter, biggest leap in that average vacancy rate. It's now at 11.4% for all malls. Again, this is an average across the country. Yeah. And that's the highest that Moody's has ever tracked. So, you know, if you're walking through the mall and or as you're going back out, maybe getting back to the mall for the first time in a long time, and you notice a lot of empty stores, you're certainly not alone. I think that's a trend that we're seeing across the country. And so now it's landlords, you know, it's time for them to look to backfill that space with new uses.
I would imagine if you see your anchor stores go dark, you know, those little stores all in between don't really have much of a fighting chance. What happens to this real estate?
Yeah, no, that's exactly normally how it kind of transpires. You see one or two of those anchors close down, and what it's an industry thing, I think, that we watch closely are these co-tenancy clauses. So that's often when a new retailer within the mall, a smaller store, you know, signs a contract. Normally there has been some sort of clause baked in where if two or three department stores or anchors close, you know, suddenly they're allowed to close. They can break their lease or they can leave early or they could ask for cheaper rent. So those co-tenancy clauses, as that gets triggered, that's really when you start to see, you know, a wave of distress kind of hit the mall. When those businesses within the mall have the option to break their lease. So in terms of new uses, I think one industry, industrial and warehouses, that's been really hot just with the rise of e-commerce. And so companies like Gap, like Kohl's, they're looking to open more distribution centers to help with their online businesses. So in some instances, we are already seeing malls that have shut for good, you know, being turned into like an Amazon warehouse, for example.
Yeah.
It's not often easy because there's
zoning
involved.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Exactly. So that makes it tricky. Industrial is one use. There's a story that was going viral a few weeks back was some kids are now going to school in an old Macy's in the mall. Oh. So it's been converted into a school. So I think there's a lot of creativity involved.
Yeah.
But again, often retail isn't the replacement.
Let's pause there with CNBC's Lauren Thomas, Reimagining Malls. She covers the state of the retail industry. Has the pandemic made you realize you have enough clothes? Do you work in retail? What's your experience been like in these times? Are you thinking of seizing on the vacant storefronts and opening up your own apparel store in your community? What are the prospects like for small businesses and clothing? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Lauren Thomas here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about clothes shopping in the pandemic and the state of retail. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The Washington Post recently reported that people are buying clothes and shoes, which could be a harbinger of life returning to some form of pre-pandemic normal. Are you clothes shopping? And if so, where? 800-642-1234. Lauren Thomas is a reporter for CNBC covering retail and retail real estate as we've been talking about the mall situation. And she's with us for 10 more minutes. Lauren, let's switch gears here and look at sustainability for a moment. Are many clothes that shoppers have been wearing, are they throwing them away? What is the landscape like for sustainability with clothes?
Sure. It's a great question. And increasingly, I think that it's top of mind for many in the retail industry. So there are these secondhand marketplaces of sorts that are really growing in popularity. So places like Poshmark, ThredUp, Depop is another one I think that is a lot more popular, especially with Gen Z and younger consumers. But yeah, these marketplaces where basically you can sell your clothes, you know, clean out your closet, get rid of stuff, and then buy stuff secondhand as well. You know, Poshmark and ThredUp actually just went public earlier this year. Both of them that IPO'd, and I think that that in and of itself is kind of a signal of the growing interest in this space and also just the success of these businesses. Now, I mentioned Gen Z a second ago, and I think in many ways they're really driving this trend. I think that you see younger consumers just more mindful of sustainability, ESG, and the environment as they think about where they're shopping. There was a new survey that actually just came out this morning. Piper Sandler, twice each year, they survey thousands of teens and kind of get a sense of what they're buying, where they're shopping, and that sort of thing. And when they asked them, what is the most important political or social issue to you, the environment was number two. So ranks very high on a list, and it's just very top of mind for these Gen Z consumers, and their spending power is obviously increasing each year. And so I think retailers, more and more of them, are just becoming mindful of that. You've seen a number of department stores like Macy's, you know, partner with these secondhand marketplaces like ThredUp. And so looking for ways to kind of tie that in to their business model. Rent the Runway, you know, is another platform that the idea of you can rent your clothes, you know, send them in. Your waste is reduced more and more. And so, it's something that's been really interesting to watch. And I think we're going to see more of those traditional retailers look for ways to incorporate that into their business.
How important is teen spending in retail?
Oh, yeah, it's really important. I think it's always watching that younger generation is something that analysts and investors are looking at closely because, like I said, their spending power is growing and they're driving these purchase decisions on their own. Mm-hmm. And I think that's often the generation that companies want to look to and kind of cater their business toward them. And so again, from this Piper Sandler survey, which is something that a lot of us pay attention to each year, teens are now reporting that they'll spend about $2,165 this year. So that's still down year over year from, you know, last spring when this was done at the onset of the pandemic, this survey, but it is ticking up from what Piper Sandler was seeing in the fall. So the last fall when this survey was done, I mean, teen spending, like, you know, many categories of spending, kind of bottomed out. It did hit a low. And so we're starting to see that tick back up. And teens are saying they're looking to buy more clothes, females in particular. I mean, they're devoting about a third of their wallets. Female teens are devoting that to apparel. So that's, again, as we're looking for green shoots and kind of signs of getting back dressed back up again in this new survey, you know, female teens are saying that they're spending more on clothes, they're spending more money on shoes, and they're doing a lot of that online still. But secondhand apparel, you know, thrift stores and consignment stores are, again, they're top of mind. And it's a place that a lot of these younger consumers are going to refresh their closets with new things.
We're talking with Lauren Thomas. She is a reporter for CNBC covering the retail industry. We're talking about apparel, malls. You can join in. When was the last time you added to your wardrobe? Are you buying clothes for work or travel? Are you an eco-conscious shopper? Maybe you are going on these online marketplaces like Depop or Poshmark. 800-642-1234. Lauren, how much has the government stimulus helped the retail industry, buoyed the retail industry? What are you seeing?
Yeah, I think it's been huge for the retail industry. And I think many executives, you know, they have said it and will probably continue to say that. They've seen a boost, I think, each time that those payments, you know, we've had multiple now. So each time that those payments have gone out, businesses have seen a boost. But a bit of a, you know, to one point, I guess, of to interject there is that not all retailers are seeing that boost equally. So especially last year, you know, when these payments were going out, and you could argue in more dire times, it was companies like Walmart, Target that sell groceries, you know, a little bit of everything and maybe cater to a lower income consumer to begin with. They really saw, I think, more of a boost there. So it was a bit of a story of winners and losers within the retail industry, and especially in terms of where those stimulus dollars were going. So that was a point of time where consumers, they still needed, you know, necessities like groceries and household cleaners and that sort of thing, Clorox wipes, you know, and so the money was going toward that. So it was going toward places like Amazon and Walmart that sell those goods.
Even
dollar stores.
Let's pause right here. Let's bring in Heidi in Winona. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead.
Hi. I am new to this long fashion. I have just discovered a company online that does a challenge where you buy a wool dress from them and you wear it for 100 days. You document that on social media, and then when you're completed the challenge, you get a gift certificate toward $100 so that you can learn about sustainability and, you know, just pare down and simplify your life.
Have you done it, Heidi?
I ordered my dress and it's going to be here June 11th.
Oh, my goodness. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Can I ask, where was the name of the place that you bought that from, Heidi?
It's called Wool And.
Huh. Okay. No, I haven't heard of that myself. So I'm going to have to look into it, but that's really interesting.
Yeah, I'm also going to extend the challenge and not spend money on my appearance that whole time so that I really take heart of the challenge of simplifying.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Can I ask a follow up with a question for you? How did you hear about the challenge? I'm curious.
It was a Facebook ad.
Nice. Yeah, well, those work.
apparently, they got my money.
Yeah.
Heidi, has this been
really
something? Yeah, Heidi, has this been something you've wanted to do for a while with your approach to sustainability?
Well, honestly, I've tried to live simple, but I'm also that Target and Amazon mom. And I thought, you know, this would be great to break those habits because it's always been in the back of my mind, but I've never really taken action with it.
Well, Heidi, thank you for bringing that to the table. Lauren, you know, in the last couple seconds we have left, what are you paying attention to with retail's future?
Sure. So I think one of the, you know, I'm watching traffic every day to stores and kind of how that's trending and how people are returning. Right now, it's a different story in different states. You're seeing places like Florida and Texas. There's been a bit of a rebound to the mall, so to speak, faster. So that definitely day to day. And then just fashion as well. You know, are we shifting away from athleisure and getting back to getting dressed up again. So those are two things that I would say are very top of mind and kind of indicate where the state of the retail industry is headed next.
Yeah. Lauren, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun. I appreciate the time.
Lauren Thomas is a reporter for CNBC covering the retail industry. Ahead this hour, we visit Iowa to learn about transforming dams into whitewater parks. The conversation comes courtesy of a listener request. Bring on your questions on making recreational water trails, 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about two friends who served in the Vietnam War together.
James Blankenheim and Everett Wood are friends with a shared experience of military service during the Vietnam War. They speak of the excitement of forging one's path in life, the realities of combat, and the struggles of integration after returning home. Blankenheim and Wood shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative. As a warning, parts of the story describe battleground violence.
My name is Jim Blankenheim, 71 years old, and I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. And my partner here is a corpsman that was with me in Vietnam.
My name's Everett T. Wood, and my age is 73. And I'm in Vincennes, Indiana. The relationship to Jim is he was a forward observer with us and called in artillery airstrikes and tried to help us out during the bad times when we needed help. So how did you get involved? Did you get drafted?
No, I enlisted. My father, when I turned 18, made the comment that he thought I'd never amount to shit. And I said, I'll show you. And not only would I join the military, but I would join the toughest branch they had. That's how I got the Marine Corps. And also, I felt I needed to do my duty anyway. It's run through our family. So how about you, Doc?
Well, I got off high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. My parents didn't have very much money. You know, I didn't want them to help me through school. You know, I just wanted to be on my own and try to find my own direction, I guess. So I joined the Navy. So remember Hill 1192?
Oh, yeah. That was probably the bloodiest battle we saw.
That was the worst I've ever gone through.
There was like 80 of us walked up into the mountains on what they said was going to be a three-day patrol. What was it, 15 days later we got out of there?
15 guys died up on that hill.
That we had no place to put the bodies or the wounded, so they all laid right in the middle of our mini perimeter. And Milligan was there. He got shot in the chest and shot in the leg.
Right. I patched him up.
He lasted 4 days before we could medevac him out. And when he went out, I thought he was dead. I thought he'd never make it. We went to that reunion in Ohio, and he showed up there, and I went, you got to be kidding me. You're alive?
I know.
Because I didn't think he made it.
I didn't even know.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, once they left, we put them on a helicopter.
Yeah, it's the last you heard.
I mean, you don't know if they're alive or dead. They never hear from them. So it's tough.
Did you ride home?
I rode home when I could, you know.
I could not tell my mother what was going on over there because it would have killed her.
Yeah, I know.
I just said, you know, like, you know what it was for us for a typical day? That's all I called it. You remember when we came home? The welcome home we got?
I don't know. I mean, I had problems adjusting when I came back.
Yeah, so did I.
I kissed the ground when I got home, when I got in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I come home, and I walk in the door, and my dad was totally unaware that I was even coming home. And I walked in, and he gave me this big hug. And in my entire life, he never hugged me like that. And I said, you know, for every rotten thing you ever did to me, you
paid for it that day.
I mean, I was really happy to be back after seeing all the stuff we went through. I'm glad we made it through that experience together.
Yeah.
And after all these years, meeting each other again.
That was James Blankenheim of Madison, Wisconsin, and Everett Wood of Vincennes, Indiana. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, reimagining low-head dams and converting them into whitewater parks and fish passageways. This conversation, it comes to us from a listener suggestion. Dwayne emailed to say he wanted to learn more about Iowa's efforts to remove dangerous dams. Our team did some digging, and sure enough, over the past decade, Iowa has become a national leader in its water trails and low-head dam public hazard program. What questions do you have about turning dams into whitewater parks? How would you feel about removing a dam in your community? 800-642-1234 to join in. And Dwayne, thanks for the tip. Nate Hogevein is Director of River Programs for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Nate, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you.
Good morning. The DNR says these low-head dams are really dangerous. Give us a picture in our mind's eye what these dams look like.
They're basically a wall across a river that backs the river up, usually just a little bit. It might only be a couple feet high. Sometimes they're up to, you know, 10 or 12 feet high. And the water, you know, isn't controlled or anything like you, like when you think of a big flowage type dam in northern Wisconsin. It's more of a, you know, just constantly falling over this wall.
A deep, and, yeah, a drop.
And what happens is the water drops straight down in a very uniform way, and then it launches back up and creates something called a hydraulic or a boil line. And from there, water is going downstream, but it's also flowing back upstream toward the dam because it's a high spot on the water. And so what happens is people sometimes get stuck in these. And in Iowa, at least, we see 1 to 2 fatalities per year on average. Sometimes we don't see any, sometimes we see more than that, but on average, that's about what we see. And so back in 2008, our legislature, after there was a rash of drownings at these dams, created the Lowhead Dam Public Hazard Program to address these dangers. And they mandated us to start spending some funds and working with communities around the state to address that hazard, and at the same time incorporate fish passage into any project that we were involved in.
And then lo and behold, whitewater parks come out of this brainstorm, if you will.
Right. certain communities have opted to do whitewater parks. And I should say that, you know, that's not our primary goal exactly, other than that, you know, when we go into a community and talk to them about what they might do with their dam, it's on the list of things that they're welcome to look at. And we've taken an approach saying that, you know, we can do anything from a removal to more of a utilitarian type of rapids, if there's a infrastructure reason that the dam is there. Or, you know, these kind of more economic development driven projects, whitewater courses, are on the table. It's just that they require a lot more local funding and a lot more local interest and effort because they're more expensive than other approaches.
How much more expensive are we talking about? What is the cost of one of these?
So the most recent one that was completed in Ames was about an $880,000 project. I just got all of their grant information back, And that would be one of the lower cost ones.
Mm-hmm.
We have four of these facilities in Iowa at this point. They're the most expensive one was about $2.5 million. That was in Manchester, Iowa, on the Maquoketa River. And there's one being planned currently in Des Moines right now, at the Scott Avenue Dam, which is, it's on a very large river, and it's in the middle of the city, and the dam is integrated into a bridge, and it's a very expensive project. That one will be, at this point I can say tens of millions of dollars. When the final design comes out, we'll know exactly how much that is. That one's partly being federally funded as well.
How common are these low head dams used for rivers in Midwestern states like your own, like Iowa?
Oh, they're extremely common. And a lot of these were originally mill sites, and they weren't necessarily like a concrete dam across a river. They might've been a pile of rocks that, backed up some water that was used to drive a water wheel at one point. But a lot of them were converted to like small hydropower dams that later, became economically inefficient as other ways of generating power developed. Some of them are created in the Great Depression, actually, mm-hmm. As basically projects to keep people working.
Public works, mm-hmm.
Public works projects, yeah. And so a few of them are created more for water supply. In a lot of those cases, we would advise the community to, replace the low head dam with a rapids type of structure. Because they still have some purpose. They're around for a lot of reasons, and a lot of them have outlived their original purpose, at least. We see a lot of deterioration because a lot of these are pushing 100 years old or more. Mm. So a lot of times the communities we're working with are at a decision point. We're either going to have a failure or we need to do something. And nobody, at least in Iowa, is really paying or helping people financially to refurbish a dam as a low head dam. So that helps us get a foot in the door with these communities.
Yeah, look at next steps or, where you go from here. We're talking with Iowa DNR River Programs Director Nate Hogevane, who is explaining his state's efforts over the years to remove or modify these low head dams and perhaps to make way for more recreational uses and to mitigate the hazards that dams present. Have you visited one of Iowa's whitewater parks? What do you remember about the experience? How concerned are you about the safety of dams? Does the dam in your community have adequate fencing or signage? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Nate Hogevane here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about turning dangerous dams into river recreation and the Iowa model. The first Iowa whitewater park was built in Charles City in 2010, closer to the Wisconsin border. Elkader boasts a single wave that is 22 feet wide. It's called the Gobbler. And here in Wisconsin near Madison, the city of Stoughton is working on plans for a whitewater park along the Yahara River. Would you go this route to remove a dam from your community? How do you feel about the viability of these whitewater park projects? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. We have River Programs Director at the Iowa DNR, Nate Hogevane, who's with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call on this, Nate. Tom is joining us from Burlington with a question. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Here in Burlington, we have a dam that is dammed up Echo Park, and The park is it's only about 6 inches of water in there, so they have to do something about it, but they're afraid to do something because every time they try to drain it, there's so much cow manure it smells, and the neighbors don't want them to drain it. But my question is this. Out west, we have these aquifers that are sucking up all the water. They're dropping it at an incredible weight, like some rate, like 40 feet a year or something, brother. And I just wonder, is there any way we can tie this in the rivers that we have on top of the land to get the water down into replacing these aquifers?
All right, Tom, thank you. So, Tom, concerned about aquifers drying up, can there be any solution with these rivers and, you know, perhaps the dams?
So western water issues and eastern water issues, and I'd say, you know, Iowa's kind of the last eastern state. I'd draw that line at about the Missouri River. Those issues are really different, the biggest difference is rainfall. So like in Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, we're getting from, 20 to almost 30 inches a year. And, out west, you might have like 12 or 15. I think in the Midwest, I had mentioned water supply earlier as a purpose of some of the dams, and sure. Yeah. They can help create a shallow aquifer in some cases. And, like I said, we are able to, really accomplish the same purpose by building, say, a rock arch rapids with boulders and smaller stone. But that's really just for collecting water, out in kind of a sand lens near the river. Mm-hmm. In terms of our deep aquifers, which I think he was referring to, those are recharged over a very long period of time, but we don't have those disappearing aquifers in the Midwest like they do out west.
Tom, thanks for the call. John is joining us now from Menominee. Hi, John, go ahead. I understand you've paddled some of these whitewater parks before.
Good morning. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm a kind of a novice whitewater paddler. I enjoy getting out there and recreating with friends and people I'd like to hang out with. And, Wausau has got probably our premier whitewater park in Wisconsin, and some might argue in the Midwest. And I've paddled that many times. And, we'll travel around northern Wisconsin to find whitewater, the Red River, the Peshtigo, the Wolf, and go up to the Brule. And we have some whitewater over here in west central Wisconsin at Jim Falls on the Chippewa River, which is part of the dam release from the Chippewa. And I just, I think that these parks provide a great opportunity for people who have interest in paddling. It brings people will travel to come and paddle in those parks, and they, it brings up opportunities for local training and local groups and clubs to kind of congregate around these features. And I just think it would be a really great thing for any community to take that dam and transition it into a whitewater park if it's at all feasible to do that with your elevations.
John, thank you so much. So John really getting out there on these paddling trips and really bringing in that tourism piece and that community interaction, Nate.
Yeah, John, and thanks for bringing up some great rivers that bring up some great memories. I cut my teeth on whitewater in Wisconsin rivers, I actually first learned to do it from the Hoofers at UW-Madison. So, it really what you're saying has bared out for communities in Iowa, and I can give you an example at Manchester, Iowa. There's a whitewater course with six separate drops that was created in 2012, and we actually did a study of how many people we would see on random days throughout the summer season, just in the area around the dam. We did that for 3 years leading up to the project being completed, and then did it for three more years after the project was completed. This is just people recreating either on the water, fishing, walking along the river. we saw a 462 times increase in the amount of time people were spending along the river.
Wow.
You also started to see other things like, you know, the a lot of downtowns in Iowa, at least, have kind of turned their backs on the river. You know, like their main street might be like a block off a river. And, you know, just all the backs of the buildings that are facing the river. In Manchester, what's happened is people started building back decks on restaurants and bars, and a brewery opened up. You know, it's just much more lively now. It's a kind of park setting with some retail mixed in.
So you saw that economic investment return there. Let's bring in Mark now in Green Bay. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hey, I didn't get to the beginning of the show, but I was wondering if when you replace these dams with these rapids, does it allow fish to move through the river system that weren't allowed to before?
Yeah, that's correct. We require in these projects that the there's like a lower slope area next to the whitewater drop. So the whitewater drop is steeper and creates a wave, and it's actually not that great for fish passage. It's better than the dam, but, you know, not that great. So we'll have a lower slope area with kind of more rocks protruding out and stuff where fish can burst up. And we've done a number of studies on that too to verify that the fish passage is actually happening at these facilities. We also make it so that those the fish passage part is favored when the water gets really low, like when you get into a drought condition kind of thing.
Mm.
So we're pretty careful to make sure that that is incorporated. We're very serious about that because it has a huge effect on the river upstream, both for fish, but also, you know, mussels, you know, like little clams. Their young actually hitch a ride on fish's gills in order to recolonize stretches of river. And they're really important for water quality as well. And I think we're all for that.
Yeah. Mark, thank you so much for that question. Nate, you know, as we start to wrap up here in the last few seconds, do you have any tips for communities that might want to go this direction and convert that low head dam into a whitewater park?
Sure. And I think the biggest one is, you need to start by, you know, putting out some ideas, you know, and doing some education. But the critical thing is that everybody gets listened to right up front, mm-hmm. You know, and that it becomes a whole community project, as opposed to, you know, maybe you've got one city council person and a business person with this big idea, and they're going to put it on the whole town. Yeah. I've seen that over and over again where that just doesn't work. You need to have those town hall meetings and have everybody who is interested in your river and that dam in particular needs a seat at the table and they need to be heard. When you start that way, it's just better.
Nate, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate. I very much appreciate it.
Nate Hogevane is Director of River Programs for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.